Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and a special programme with silent film music champion and posthumous Chaplin collaborator Timothy Brock. Brock's musical calling has been to save from obscurity and even disappearance silent film music of all kinds. Among his work in silent movies are soundtracks to classics such as The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu, but he's specialised in piecing together and otherwise making good a huge chunk of the music composed by Charlie Chaplin for his own films such as Modern Times and most recently Woman of Paris, a newly restored version of which will be seen in Dublin this month. A newly restored print of which, with Timothy Brock's newly restored score, will be seen in Dublin this month. Although US-born, Timothy Brock lives and works in Bologna in Italy, drawn by something unique the city has to offer, as he explained to Culture File.
I assume that it's the same reason that people are drawn close to the Irish Film Institute. I'm here because of the Cineteca di Bologna, which is probably the leading city of where most silent film and also fairly contemporary film restoration happens. It's an amazing city for film restoration and for film in general. Italy's been a very cinematic country for such a long time, at least since right after the war, Città Aperta, etc. And it is a unique city in terms of the fact that it is a very progressive city. It really believes in the restoration of cinematic masterpieces. And it's also the home, and which is the reason I came here, was because they restored the entire catalog of films and the paper archive of Charlie Chaplin.
Having, you know, you've dedicated a huge part of your life to making silent film come into our world and have a presence in our world. Tell us what you see as the value of silent film in an era of TikTok. And, you know, we feel like we've moved away from that kind of filmmaking, but I think you think there's something still that's valuable for us.
Well, I do think it's valuable. I mean, I'm not particularly very objective about it. I was into silent film since I was a little boy and started accompanying films on the piano when I was 14. So it was just something I've always wanted to do. So bit of a nerd, bit of a geek, bit of a freak. And all that comes together to a career somehow. My mother's still waiting for me to get a job, a proper job at 93. But I do think it's valuable. It gives us an idea of where cinema has come from. And I think that it teaches people to listen to a film as well as watch it. It does something that sound film can never do, which is to draw the audience in to a screen, which I think which is done through music, because music provides not only just musical accompaniment, but it also has all the sound effects in it. It's got dialogue, it's got just everything that sound was later to do in separate ways. it incorporated everything. It's an art form that was extremely common also, but now forgotten, because since 1895, there's been musicians playing silent films all the way up to 1926. And, you know, that's 30 years of seeing a film only one way, and that's silent. And it's just, I think it's not only important, but it's just a beautiful separate art form all on its own. It's not like opera, it's not like ballet, because, you know, in ballet, dancers wait for their music cue, and then they come on stage, whereas a silent film, they come on stage, and hopefully you're with them, with the film projector, and that's, you got to be together all the time. So it's a very hard question to answer, like, what value do I see in it? It's just for people from late 19th century up to the mid 20s, it was everything for them.
Obviously, you're playing most of the time, but if you go to a silent film and listen to somebody else playing and experience it that way, do you have a very different experience of what cinema is under those circumstances yourself?
Yes. It's unfortunate, though, for me, though, because I know it's hard. I have to sort of forget who I am when I go in and I watch somebody else perform. I want to experience it like everybody else does and think, instead of thinking like, oh, here's a tough one. Here's a tough spot. Okay, there, you know, so you don't want to do any of that. Yeah, I mean, I try to do that, but sometimes it's hard. Depends on how hard it is. And if it's a piece I know, like if it's one, I rarely go to performances of a score that I restored by somebody else, because then I just don't enjoy it. It's very difficult because I worry so much for him or her who's on the podium. So it's too much. But if it's a film I don't know and it's a score I don't know, I have a great time. I think it draws me in like everybody else.
Is it a different experience to sound film, though? Like what you're doing kind of cognitively, emotionally, what's happening to you? Is it different if you go to a sound film with talking and, you know, built-in sound effects?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much like everybody else when they go to a film. But I, of course, when the music is, you know, involved in a scene in a contemporary film, I analyze it more. I think, does that work? Is that working? But, you know, again, I can do what I do just fine, but I'm not sure if I could be a contemporary film composer myself. There's just so much noise. Somebody's talking over the music. What is that? You know, or is there a car crash? Could they not shut the window? It was very, it's very annoying. So, you know, it's, but still, I don't think I could do that. And also you have to collaborate with living people. And that's something I don't ever do either.
What kind of a composer was Chaplin? I mean, this is the thing that people may not know, that the scores you're working on have their roots in Chaplin's own work, his own compositions.
The thing is that Charlie was a composer before he was an actor. He was playing, or at least a musician before he was an actor. And he, you know, was in the 8 Lancaster Lads as a child, performing on stage, both musically and in dance. His parents were both professional musicians in the English Music Hall growing up. And so music has been a very, very large part of his life since his start in the theater. And Charlie started composing his own, you know, his own songs, essentially, and publishing them in the mid-teens with the Charlie Chaplin Publishing Company. And then, of course, he took his first stab at composing for his own films in 1931 with City Lights. He was self-trained, played everything by ear, as were many, you know, Tin Pan Alley composers at the same time. Irving Berlin couldn't read a note of music, for example, and wrote thousands of songs. Charlie was one of those guys, in fact, was friends with Irving Berlin and lots of other composers. Charlie was a real magpie. He was always stealing from somebody for a good reason. I mean, that's what most composers do anyway, but he was quite shameless about it. And you know, that gold, the Gold Rush score sounds, you know, has, I mean, there's actually quite a bit of Brahms quotations in there, but there's also things like Debussy, and he's you know, and Smile is built just like a Puccini aria. I mean, he just loved music, listened to it all the time, and tried to mimic what he thought would be useful for whatever scene he was looking at. He was a composer that was very much interested in character building in his music. He would develop characters, particularly, obviously, the Tramp character. A lot of the music that he composed, I think, stems from his time with the Fred Carno Company, which was the touring English music hall group that he was a part of, and what's what actually brought him to America for the first time with Stan Laurel. He was influenced, I think, a lot by the music director of that company, who used to play music that was quite delicate, quite with a lot of finesse, while he was on stage falling about and doing amazingly funny and absurd things and through his characters on stage. But yet the music remained dignified and always rather, quote unquote, high class. That's what he, I think, applied to his own film scores throughout his life. He never started composing until the film was finished. He would play with the piano, and he would just pick out tunes and chord structures on the piano and say, I would like this, and I would write this. And but he was very specific. He told his musical associates, which is what he called them, he wanted, even if the rhythm was in 5-4 or 7-8 or something like that, he insisted that it comes out just exactly how he hears it in his head. So when he was making tunes for, like, example, Modern Times, he would pick out tunes and melodies and chord structures, and then say, then David Raxon, who was incidentally my orchestration teacher, he wrote down everything in a short score form. Then he would essentially orchestrate it after he played it back for Charlie and he gave its approval. Then he would orchestrate it, and then they'd take it into the studio. He would listen to it, and he'd give it one, sometimes just one pass, and say, no, that doesn't work, let's do it again, and start the whole process over again. And that's why it took over 6 months to do the film score, to record the film score to Modern Times, because of he made his music just as he would make his films. It's just by trial and error. There was no script, so to speak, with the music. He just said, that works, that doesn't work. So there are moments where he realized that that whole thing needs to be cut, which makes it difficult for live performances because there's sort of awkward transitions.
You have a great example of that in your restoration of the score of Women of Paris, which is kind of cutting back and forth between the boudoir and the left bank party scene.
Yes.
A smash cut back and forward.
Yes, that's probably the trickiest moment, but, you know. It's fun to do. It's fun to do when it comes off.
Your collaboration with Chaplin for Women of Paris, that came from what had been a hidden stockpile of recordings of Chaplin himself playing things.
Yeah, the score in 1976, which was made for a re-release, came at really towards the end of Chaplin's life. And his musical associate at the time, Eric James, which was his longest-serving musical associate, from 1959 to his death in 1977 was problematic, because a lot of the compositions that there just wasn't, Charlie couldn't come up with enough material. So they had to stretch it, do a lot of repeats, a lot of things like that. And it just made for a not too successful score. And the family wasn't sure what to do about it. In 2003, I think, they came across a bunch of dictation tapes of Charlie composing music for Limelight on the piano. And that's about 20 hours of him composing through dictation. As I said before, Charlie could not notate any of the music that he played. So he would play into this machine. Once this machine was invented, he'd started playing into this machine for his musical associate to transcribe all the music he was playing. I had the idea to use music that I knew was never used before in a Chaplin film. In other words, the previously unused music passages I transcribed by ear onto paper and identified about 25 pieces of music, essentially, that was never used, that Chaplin composed. And because it was composed for his only other drama, Limelight, I thought it made sense to maybe use this new material for A Woman of Paris. And so I came to the family and I said, let's just try it. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You know, it's worth it trying. And we did, and we were quite happy with the result. I used that, and also there's bits of the 1976 score that Charlie did compose. I incorporated that with this material and, you know, made a new posthumous score.
I kind of think you regard your work with silent film alongside historically informed performance in general.
Yes, definitely. It's not just a matter of the notes on paper. You have to know a considerable amount of what musicians knew and how they played in the 1920s. I mean, and that's true for any kind of music. We certainly play Brahms now like how we think it should sound. But 100 years ago, they played it very differently, you know, and depending on what region of Europe they were in and so forth, you know, sometimes the horns will be playing with vibrato and sometimes they won't. I mean, it just depends on who's playing it. But I come to a rehearsal and usually the first thing I do is talk about how Charlie was and what he did in history and musically. And I said that to them, you know, we're not playing like our parents. We're playing like our grandparents. And now at age 61, now some of those kids are so young, I have to actually go to as far as saying great-grandparents, and that's very depressing. But, you know, regardless, we have to tell them that they do not teach you in conservatory how to play like this anymore.
What are the qualities of that playing? Maybe some of the specifics.
Well, I think in the string playing, for example, you have to remember that in 1920s Hollywood, 1930s Hollywood, that the bulk of the string players were all Austro-Hungarian immigrants coming from this side of the Atlantic. And that is a very specific type of playing. I would give them models of who to sort of mimic, especially for the first violinist. I would say, you know, we're coming to the Gold Rush as if you were, you know, coming from the Misha Elman School of Music, which is a very specific type of violin playing, and they always sort of giggle and laugh. I said, but really, that's really where we're going, because that's who would have played there, or Joseph Zaghetti, or, you know, even Heifetz, you'd say. It's that type of burnished vibrato, the very intense and percussive vibrato. And if there's a staccato mark on the note, it's got to be spiccato more than piccato, you know, than staccato, which means has sort of an attack on the staccato. Instead of going da 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 da, if you go da 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 like that, like that, a violin would be expected to play. if you do it with those things, and also like portamenti, which means this the sliding of the note up into the note and the shifting of the violins, which was a common thing for Hollywood scores to have done, Hollywood players. And what that does is emotionally, it really puts you in the period of the film. Once you hear musicians playing like that, which is a very strange sound if you don't have an image to go with it, you think, wow, what's that? You know, it sounds like a 78 playing. That it will immediately transport you into that time period, and you kind of forget we're there, and you realize that, oh my God, they're really playing this like it would have been, you know? And if there's a trumpet, you should always be playing with vibrato. A trombone should be playing with a slide vibrato. And they also have the brass. I have to bring 9 different mutes for most Chaplin films for the brass to play, because those mutes don't exist anymore. In the score, it says solo tone mute or the mega mute, mellow wah, all these different mutes that they don't manufacture anymore. And I've collected them over the years, and I have to bring an extra suitcase of just trumpet and trombone mutes so that we can make that sound.
There is a sort of direct line between you and Chaplin, so I guess something specific is passed on.
Yes, I mean, my connection with David Raxon, because is my closest connection to Chaplin, besides Chaplin's own children, of course, but I mean, at least musically, yes. David was an amazing film composer in his own right, of course, being probably his most notable work as the composer for the film Laura. He was, I think, one of the best composers ever to come out of Hollywood in its history. He just told me all sorts of stories about working with Charlie, and he was only 23 at the time. David was doing orchestration and arrangements for George Gershwin in New York, personally, and also for Stravinsky. He did the orchestration for the Circus Polka March, and he came out to Hollywood based on a telegram that Charlie sent to George. He said, hey, send your boy out here. And he came out, and he was fired after a week. And he because he dared to speak up to Charlie, because nobody tells Charlie that he can't do something musically, just wouldn't have it. And he was that way his whole life with all the, and in fact, David said that there was a nice little club where it was called the I Was Fired by Charlie Club. And they all, said they wanted to walk around with all these little badges because all his friends got fired by Charlie at one point or another. Various orchestrators, Carmen Dragon and Meredith Wilson, of course, the composer of The Music Man, was Charlie's musical associate for The Great Dictator. So a long line of really great musicians worked with Charlie, but David was the one that I actually got to work with and taught me quite a bit about orchestration, especially back in the 1930s, which was different because mostly, unlike what they do now, the wind players would have to play 5 or 6 different instruments with one person. So he said that during modern times, they had saxophone players who had 5 different instruments hanging around their necks, and they didn't want to stop any takes, so they would do things in 10-minute takes, which is unbelievable. So he was great. He was absolutely invaluable for me to know how, not only how he worked, but how other composers worked, including his best friend at the time, which was Bernard Herrmann. And these are all, of course, legendary names. But it's just nice to get the inside scoop on these and about Charlie and how he worked.
How do you rate him as a composer, say alongside, the great Italian composers like Morricone or Rota or Piccinni? Does his work stand up the way theirs does, kind of with or without images?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, when I'm asked that question, I always say that Charlie Chaplin is the best composer in the world for Chaplin films. And he knows his characters. He developed those characters himself. He imitates those characters when he's trying to do a take with Virginia Sherrill in City Lights, and he has to hold up the flower 400 times to show her how to do it right. I mean, he's everybody on screen, and he's everybody in the music. So I think that there's not much difference in that. How I think he matches up, it's hard to say. The only examples we have of Charlie's music that is pure concert music is only his songs. And there's not so many of those anyway. So those songs are just definitely in the old English music hall style, or at least British music hall style. And so it's hard to compare them. Listening to them, when I've made a couple suites of Charlie's music for orchestra to play without images, the thing is that people love about them is that it brings up images. So, you know, it's hard to tell because they love the film because they love, oh, I love this scene, or I love this music. Oh, I love this music in this film, you know. But I do think it holds up, but not everything, certainly not everything. The music to the assembly line music for Modern Times, for example, is too simple, but it works only because you have something to look at when it works. But by itself, I don't think it really works all that well.
In the work, are there melodies that are as indelible as, you know, something that Morricone might have done, or in his simplest forms, I wonder?
Most people would observe that the main theme of Modern Times, which became later Smile, is probably his most recognizable song. And it is indelible, in my opinion. I don't think that can be anything else. I don't think that could have been composed by anybody else. It sounds like Chaplin through and through. I think all of Charlie's music sounds like Charlie. Charlie had 7 musical directors in his career, starting with Arthur Johnson, and then David Raxon, Eddie Powell, Alfred Newman, and eventually with Eric James, towards the end of his life. The thing is that all of those guys, who are vastly different from one another as composers and orchestrators, but they all sound like Chaplin, no matter what, because there's just no getting around that Chaplin sound when Charlie composes for a film. You can't orchestrate it out of his realm. You can't orchestrate that music in a way that doesn't sound like Chaplin, because it's just so thoroughly Chaplin.
Jackie Terrasson's take on Chaplin's Smile there. We've been talking this time to composer Timothy Brock. Archive recording of Chaplin at the Piano was thanks to the Chaplin Archive Paris, a Woman of Paris with music by Chaplin, newly restored, orchestrated and conducted by Timothy Brock, will be screened at the IFI Dublin on Saturday, 23rd of November, as part of this year's French Film Festival. We'll be back with your regular Culture File Weekly next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.